Okay, today is January 9th, 2014. This is the second interview with Jim Boffman. This is a phone interview. We're both on campus. I'm in my office in Steenbach, and at least, Jim, I assume you're in your office in Vilas.
Yes, I am.
And my name is Troy Reeves with the UW-Madison Oral History Program. Jim, since we're doing this on the phone, could you say your name and spell your last name so I can check the sound quality?
Sure. It's James Boffman, B-A-U-G-H-M-A-N.
Excellent. All right, Jim, we sort of swatted back and forth a list of things that we wanted to talk about this time, but I wonder if there's anything on your mind after we left off on Tuesday that you felt or you feel the need to either reiterate or elaborate on.
No, I don't think so. I gave that some thought, but no, I don't think so.
Okay, so our conversation chronologically brings us into the 90s now, but this is a question that might take us back to the 80s, and that's if you wouldn't mind speaking a bit to some of the graduate students you've worked with of note.
Sure. I've had a steady stream of grad students, and by that I mean in a given year I might have two or three doctoral candidates working with, and they've almost all been quite good. A couple of stand out. Jeff Smith, who's now at UW-Milwaukee but was at Iowa, was quite good, as was Jim Cates, who's now at UW-Whitewater. I'd love to take credit for their success, but they came to me as almost finished products. I really had little to offer them, but I was very proud of both of them and the good work they've done. Karen Miller, who's now at Georgia, did what I thought was a wonderful dissertation on the Hill and Knowlton public relations firm. Very clever thesis, and I mean that in a positive way. And again, one of the very best theses I directed was by Carolyn Bronstein, who is currently at DePaul University in Chicago. And Carolyn looked at the division within the women's movement regarding the movement to regulate pornography.
So, Jim, how would you describe, or you know, if you could, in this sort of broad sense, the working relationship you would have with the graduate students under your wing?
It's more what I took to be the model when I was at Columbia in the history department, which is I give them enormous autonomy in terms of, but what I do will closely edit the thesis chapters, maybe more closely than some would like, but that they're really on their own. I mean, I do what I can to help them get money and counsel regarding the structure of the thesis and that sort of thing. But there's no collaboration. It's not a hard social sciences model. I'm not, I don't write articles with in the main. They're really on their own.
Okay. And Jim, just to make sure we get this on the record, I know Carolyn was one of the dissertators who won a prize under your tutelage.
Yep.
There were a couple others. Did you mention those in the...
Jeff Smith won one, and it may have been... And I'm trying to remember who the other one was, and I'm drawing a blank.
Okay.
But how's that for parental pride?
Well, and of course, your resume that has this is in the other room, so... all right, so at least we're two out of three. So if we were playing baseball, we would be ripping the cover off of it.
Right. Go ahead.
Okay, so let's move now from graduate students to we talked quite a bit about your teaching, but I'm wondering if we could maybe talk a bit more about that, focusing on what, if anything, you consider your teaching style to be.
Well, again, I think it's pretty old school. I've rejected PowerPoint. I've rejected use of slides. I notoriously draw maps with chalk of the eastern coast of the United States and so forth. And yet I think I've been able to get away with that and still get away with it in part because I'm a performer. I will ham it up. And so I don't think the classes have resented that too much. In fact, I've heard it said to me that they actually pay more attention because because I don't use PowerPoint.
And just to reiterate, so even back, you know, before the era of PowerPoint, you weren't the type that had the slide projector either.
No, not normally. I could count on one hand the number of times I use slides in class, even though a lot of what I teach, you know, for instance, you want to show them what a newspaper looked like in 1860 or something that would lend itself to that kind of visual representation. But I've just frankly been too lazy. I concentrate on the lecture and, you know, up until literally minutes before the class begins, and then I run in and start talking.
So, I mean, does that mean you're I guess I'll use the word tinkerer? I mean, are you tinkering with lectures, even ones that you've done over and over again?
No. I don't know where this came up recently, but I think I was preparing a document for the university committee. But I think if you're not looking at your lectures every time before you lecture, you know, if you're not going over your notes every time, you got to be fired. You know, there's so much research, that's new research going on. How can I, or how can I clarify this? Is this really clear? The other problem, Troy, and this may well happen to you, is the more you know, the harder it is to convey information to your students. When I was an assistant professor, teaching came rather easy by comparison, because I was usually one class ahead of them in terms of presenting material. But as I learned more, I found myself having to stop and weed out information that I realized, you know, they don't, you know, this isn't important. They don't need to hear this. And I'm probably still guilty of packing too much information in my lectures and losing sight of the larger points that I want to convey or share.
So just to confirm, so you don't tinker with your lecture per se?
Oh, I do. I do. But the tinkering in two ways. I try to bring fresh material in. I'm always looking for articles and books that, let's say I'm lecturing on the press of the American Revolution. I'm trying to keep up with that literature, which is huge, and get a sense of what's out there that might cause me to change my interpretation of that I'm presenting to my students.
Okay, thank you.
That's the first thing. But then that becomes a trap in that you learn too much and you've got too much information. And I've gotten some brushback on that and realized, no, they don't, you know, this would be fine if it were a grad seminar or if, you know, they had nothing else on to do with their lives for me to pile on like this. But I have to start editing your lectures more carefully the more you learn.
Okay. So let's move from teaching then to some of your writing and research in the 90s. You know, looking at your resume, it appears it may not have been book-length stuff, but you were doing quite a few articles, book reviews, and giving papers at conferences.
Right.
So, you know, after that second book, what was some of the major research you were doing that led to these articles?
And well, let me explain what happened. There, in between 85 and 92, I did three books. The revision of my dissertation on the FCC, the biography of Henry Luce, and then a book called Republic of Mass Culture, which came out in 92, which was an attempt to offer kind of a synthesis history of the major media in America since 1941. So I was a little burned out at that point. I was 40, but I still had a big book that I wanted to do and that I eventually did finish 15 years later, and that was Same Time, Same Station, A History of Television in the 1950s. And that book had been on my list of goals from when I was a dissertator in the late 70s, but I finally finished it. But so what I'm trying to say is there was a 15-year interval between the completion of the third book and the fourth books. And during that period, a couple things. One is I did a couple of new editions of Republic of Mass Culture, but you're right, a lot of time was spent doing shorter pieces, conference papers, encyclopedia entries, which can be the bane of scholars, I've discovered. But at the same time, I was trying to do an ongoing, my ongoing research was on 50s television.
So during this time, what kind of research would you do to continue progression to what eventually became Same Time, Same Station?
Well, it was essentially two things, three things. One, I should say, one is that there's a sizable amount of material here at the Historical Society, anchored by the NBC collection, which the Society's had for some decades. But there are other secondary collections that relate to this. But the main divide after that was going to Washington, D.C., which had a lot of materials on the first 10, 15 years of television in the National Archives. And then going to California, three different occasions, to look at manuscript collections there, mostly involving talent, people who were on television during that time, like Milton Berle, and looking at their papers.
Where would the papers of the individuals be held?
UCLA had a lot of them. There were some at USC. It seems to me there were some other archives that are escaping me now. The Directors Guild had some nice materials. UCLA also had a wonderful video library, which I could go in at night or in the afternoons and literally watch old shows that had been donated to their video library.
Jim, so was this research you were doing in the 90s and 2000s to lead towards the book, did some of that research then come out in some of these either conference papers or articles?
Some of it did. Troy, I'd have, you know, and then there were, you know, there were, you know, that, some of it did. And although in the main, I would say that in thinking about this, that the book really was, I was not doing a lot of articles from the book, if that's what you're asking. It was that doesn't mean some of this other research didn't get done, but it was doing mostly saving it for the big event.
Okay. So to maybe go a bit more about these the conference papers. Did you have a conference or an organization or two that sort of became your organization of choice, per se?
Well, you know, that I found myself doing a fair amount with a group called the Business History Conference, which is an organization of people who are business historians. Now, many of them are now labeling themselves historians of capitalism, which I think is a little high hat, but this is a group, people in business schools or who teach what has been called business history at schools like Wisconsin and Ohio State. And they will meet, they meet every year. And for some reason, I found that to be a nice landing spot for some of my research. In other words, I could, they were plainly interested in what I was doing, because my focus with my book, with my TV book, was on the sort of the institutional arrangements that emerged. Why did TV take the shape it did? Not why did TV ruin me and your parents? That sort of thing. I was more interested in why how the rules of TV production and emerged. And I, again, I think I found a willing audience with the Business History Conference, and it was a good group. It was a smaller conference, so that was fun and it made it worthwhile.
Thank you. But there's other conferences that you've attended too, like, you just came back from AHA. So are there other organizations that you also have spent time with, either at their conferences or just in their organizations?
Well, the AHA and the OAH have been, they're really big. Organization of American Historians, American Historical Association are big. And the problem when you go to a meeting like that is that there are so many people going and there's so many sessions, and this happened to me. And maybe it was because it was me, but sometimes people won't show up at your session. and, you know, you're sort of asking your wife and homeless people to show up because the room is so bare. Now, we didn't have that experience in January this month, but that's one problem with a big conference, is that there's so much going on that, you know, you can give a paper and just not have the turnout that you would like. The smaller conferences, it's harder to get away with that.
So, Jim, it sounds like, you know, presenting a paper for you is not so much just being able to have another line on the CV, but actually having sort of butts in the seats to be able to ask questions or you know, comment on what you're trying to do.
Oh, I don't mind. You know, I think you're making me sound more altruistic than I am about this. I think a lot of us do. A lot of people I know do conference papers because it's an opportunity. It's an excuse to go to a meeting because the department will pay some or all of your costs. But what does that mean? Well, in my case, and I mean this, I'm no spring chicken. I always come away from an academic conference reinvigorated, learning something I didn't know, finding out about books that are coming out that I didn't realize. It's great if I can share my research with people and get some feedback, but usually, to be perfectly honest, Troy, the major benefit is that I'm in contact with the more recent work that's going on in the field. And try as you might, reading scholarly journals and so forth, there's something about a conference that keeps you on your toes.
All right. Thank you.
Again, it's great to get feedback on your work, but frankly, that's a crapshoot. It depends who shows up and so forth. But, and again, I'm not trying to sound too cynical about this, about going to meetings. But I rarely come back from a meeting not having felt that it was not worth it. I always feel it. I got something out of it, sometimes a lot. The other group I would mention to your question is called the Policy History Conference, which meets every other year. As my research now has moved back into journalism and politics, that's become a wonderful opportunity or platform for me to present research to people who are interested in politics and political history.
So, Jim, I think I thought of this, but I didn't put it down in the topic list. And it's not necessarily a question about your mid-career, but maybe just in general, how did you balance, you know, once you became a professor, you didn't have the dissertation, how did you balance the research and the teaching, you know, and still obviously having a life and being able to sleep and eat and all that other stuff?
Mm-hmm. You know, there was something I went through in the late 80s. This was several years after I got tenure. I think I sort of calmed down a little bit. and I realized that the school was really under a lot of strain at that time. I'm talking about maybe 86, 87. And I don't remember exactly when it went, but I want to say it was the late 80s that I came to realization, look, I may be stressed out, or I may have been stressed out, but I'm not going to take it out on my students. You know, I'm going to serve them well. I'm going to try to be as conscientious an instructor. I'm not saying I wasn't that way before, but I think there were moments in the mid-80s when I was just, again, without saying I had burnout, I was just, you know, maybe I was sometimes phoning it in. I'm not sure my students would agree with me, but you know what I'm saying. I realized, hey, look, you know, I owe it to the students to give them my all, and maybe in some ways rededicated myself to my teaching, even though, again, I think it was always pretty good, but maybe it was just an internal wake-up call, if that's possible.
Okay. So was it this time in the late 80s, too, that you talked towards the end of our first interview about the ballooning enrollments and the necessity to sort of revamp who would get into school? Was that going on at that time, too?
Yeah, and that was, and as I say, that helped, because what it allowed us to do was to control who got into the major. And in effect, what we found was that by doing so, the students we were admitting just worked a bit harder than the ones who weren't getting in. There's nothing more frustrating as a teacher to find that students aren't trying, that they aren't applying themselves, that they aren't listening to you. It's a little bit like being a parent. and that was, we were teaching fewer of those students after we raised the enrollment enrollment standards, made it harder to get into the school. And so the students you were encountering were better motivated, were harder workers, and that happened. That happened again when we revisited the curriculum in 2000, 2001.
Okay. So you were on the curriculum committee.
Yes.
You know, from the early 90s through that.
Right.
As you said, that second revamp.
Right.
So I guess how would you characterize the decade on there? Was the work mainly done in those last couple of years when you revamped?
Last couple of years, and boy, I'd love to take credit for the end product, but I stepped down just before we reached the finish line. I was getting a little frustrated. The problem we were dealing with was we were proposing changes in the curriculum that were going to affect a lot of our faculty, meaning they were going to have to rethink, you know, their teaching, maybe, you know, rethink their lesson plans. And that's not always popular. You know, people don't necessarily want to change the way they've been doing things. So we were having trouble agreeing on what direction we were going to go in. And a very specific example, brief one, is we realized it made a lot of sense on multiple levels to combine advertising and public relations, to no longer teach them separately. But boy, that was a hard sell to make to people who were used to teaching one or the other. So it took us a number of years. By that I mean, I want to say 5-6 years to get over that hump and to get people to accept the new curriculum. Because what we were in effect doing was streamlining our instruction and enhancing it, I would say, at the same time.
So did that make some of those committee meetings contentious?
Yes. Although, actually, the committee meetings were wonderful. And again, I'd love to take credit for this, but a key player on that was my retired colleague, Bill Blankenberg. And I think Bill was the one who really led us, and along with one or two other colleagues, came up with a couple of key elements to our new curriculum. One was a course which we now offer, 202, which we were going to require of all majors, that they all had to take, and it had a pretty heavy skills basis. But I'd love to take credit, be carried around campus on a sedan chair, not today, but about this. But it was Bill and a couple other people who figured out how to square the circle and how to come up with a revision.
Okay.
That was really a revision that really took us out of the 1950s, because that's what we were, in many ways, we were teaching, Troy. When I came here, we were teaching a 1950s journalism curriculum.
And so then it took 20-ish years to sort of kick you out of that?
Well, the whole industry was sitting on its hands. You may remember. And so we were actually ahead of most all journalism schools in realizing that, for example, our reporting classes had to de-emphasize newspapers as a platform, that we needed to realize there was this thing called the web and the internet. And so on and so forth. And we were ahead of most programs. It is very hard to change curriculum, though. You know, it just is. And even faculty who I think saw this new landscape were reluctant to accept it, because it would mean they'd have to change their lesson plans. So the thing that occurred in the mid-90s is, in effect, the dean of the college cut our lecture budgets, and what that meant was that we were actually as a faculty going to have to teach a lot of the courses that we had on the books. The trouble was that they were spread all over. You had PR, you had TV news, you had radio news, photojournalism, you know, and a smattering of courses that we individually couldn't cover anymore, we were used to getting a lecturer from the Cap Times and the State Journal to come in. And so we realized, you know, we better come up with a curriculum that is current and that we can actually teach.
I'm just writing that down. You there, Jim?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm doing the old radio trick.
We had dead air there for a second. Never a good thing in a phone interview. So I wonder if there's a way you could sort of give a for example about how an idea in a committee sort of makes its way to become a reality or for whatever reason doesn't. I don't know which, you know, if you have an example of either.
I'd have to think about that, because I think a key moment in our deliberations in the 90s came when I believe it was Bill Blankenberg and a bunch of us had this exchange. One reason we were slow to act was we've always been a fairly small department, and we've worried a lot about what the deans would think. Well, we can't do this because the deans might not like it, or the deans might not let us do it. That is to say, they may not fund it, they may not give us the TAs we need, or we may need to hire a special person, and so we better not do this. And I distinctly remember the meeting, I couldn't give you the date, when Bill Blankenberg said to us all, let's do what we want to do and not worry about the deans. See, then, you know, let's drop this curriculum rather than pre-censor what we're doing. Let's come up with what we think is the ideal curriculum for a 21st century journalism program, and then see if we can sell it to the deans. And I think that was just a glorious, you know, glorious moment for us, because we all agreed, okay, what the heck? What's the worst thing he can do? Shoot us? You know, I mean, the dean doesn't carry a gun. So that was our decision.
Okay.
And in fact, that allowed us, I think, to be much more innovative and daring than we would have been otherwise. And at the same time, we were in fact able to persuade the dean to let us, you know, reallocate TAs, reallocate staffing in a much more dramatic way than we might have otherwise.
So, Jim, before your time as head of the school, because we'll talk about that in a separate session, would you have direct relationship or contact with the dean or other higher-ups in administration?
Just occasionally, Troy. I would, you know, I might see the deans if I were escorting a search candidate up, or if I was at a social function. I knew Dean Cronin, for example, socially. I'd see him and his wife at events. I even remember riding the bus with him one time. But my contact was very limited.
Okay. So I want to... A couple more things.
Sure.
Well, more than a couple more things.
But that's all right.
So a couple things that I don't think will take a lot of time, but I want to ask them. So I want to ask about the process, if there is one, or was one for you, towards becoming a full professor in 1990.
You know, that was interesting, because it happened rather quick. Let's see, when did I become a full professor?
I think your CV says it was 1990.
Wow.
Well, anyway, the adjectives were taken off then on your CV. You know, by 90 it just says professor.
Yeah. I've got it online here. I'm just checking to see what lies and fictions I've spread on this thing. Just kidding. No, you're right. I'm sorry. You're right. I was just having a brain cramp. That happened rather quickly, Troy, but Jim Hoyt was still director of the school and said he wanted to do this. He asked for some names. You were doing letters at that time, and I was able to provide him with some to write letters on behalf of the promotion. I'm assuming here that the the key element was that my second book had come out and had gotten a small award from Journalism Scholarship Society, if that's not, you know, an oxymoron, and a couple of other things. So they got some buzz. So that may have helped.
Okay.
But I was not privy to who made the final decision, but it was very nice. But I had a second book out, which is, that's a normal standard in a, you know, it used to be the old standard in history, but I think that was the factor, the main element.
Okay. Are there any either financial or other changes occur when you become a full professor?
I think there was a slight salary bump, but that's about it.
Okay.
That's about it.
Excuse me.
No, I gotcha.
So there was something I wanted to ask, and you said in your email to me that it wasn't probably a deep discussion, but it appears you had the Irwin Meyer Faculty Development Award for a few years in the 90s. Could you maybe just explain what that is and how
that's money that we received from an old Milwaukee Journal executive. I think Meyer gave us that money years ago for faculty development, as they call it. And it's a wonderful award. We have a series of those in the school. And what it in effect does is it gives you a stipend if you're going to travel, which I do, and research trips and stuff like that. So that was very nice, and it meant a lot to me. And I remember telling my mom and dad, and then they told all their friends. You would have thought I'd won the Oscar or something, but that was nice. It's a modest stipend, but you know, you can understand, Troy, the cost of travel and so forth. It was just nice to be able to have that picked up and have some help with it.
So maybe not specifically, but in general, it would help you travel to, say, either California or D.C. to research the book?
Sure.
Okay.
And I may have used some of that money when, I'm trying to remember when the award came, but, you know, just, right, to various projects, and if I wanted to use a manuscript collection to be able to go do that, make that trip without worrying too much about the cost.
Okay. So I want to talk a little bit here about being on the editorial board of the Journalism Quarterly.
Sure.
So maybe first, let's start off just by how that happened, and we'll go from there.
Well, I'm not sure exactly when it started, but I was going for a long time, was going to the Association for Education and Journalism meetings, and I got to know people in other departments, and ended up being invited and serving on the JQ board, and also the Board of Journalism History, which is published by Ohio University.
So what does it mean, you know, specifically in this case, to be on the board of Journalism
Quarterly? Well, I think there are two sort of responsibilities, one of which I've never honored, which is to attend the meeting at every convention, annual meeting of the AHA, to deliberate on the journal. The other more serious obligation is to, you're expected to review manuscripts for JQ, and that I was more than willing to do.
Not in specifics, but just in general, how did you see the scholarship during the time that you were on the board?
I think that's a great question, and I think initially, and boy, if you ever caught people who knew me early in my career, they would, you know, they would be throwing bricks at my window. But initially, I was a very prickly reader. I got through a pretty rigorous graduate program, and was pretty appalled by what I saw as some pretty weak submissions by people. As I got older, I realized that two things. Many of the submissions came from people who did not, in fact, have a very good training. And so I should, you know, give them some, you know, show a little more mercy or something, and I shouldn't be so judgmental and angry, because I was in some cases. I distinctly remember telling one editor, does this writer know where the library is? I was that mad. part of the problem was that a lot of people who were doing communication history in the 80s and even the early 90s were coming out of comm programs, and they'd taken few, if any, history classes. So they didn't, you know, they might know their literature. They might know what historians of communication have written about, say, Vietnam or World War I and the press. But if you try to nudge them and get them to realize that people outside of comm programs have also written about this, you get this blank look. They didn't know what, you know, as if they were, you know, the scholarship didn't exist. And that was pretty infuriating, because it wasn't that hard to keep track of that literature. I mean, it's not easy, but it wasn't that hard. So you'd, and what I was struck by then was the insularity of a lot of the people doing this work, that they just didn't look at enough stuff. But I will say, Troy, that over time, I think the submissions got stronger. I think more people were doing archival work, manuscript, you know, using manuscript collections, not relying exclusively on printed documents. So the submissions have gotten stronger, but I'm still disappointed that we have not, as a group, gotten better, that the work still isn't as good as it could be.
Jim, again, I don't have the CV handy, but are you still doing that work for Journalism Quarterly, or was
No,
that...
I just deleted it from my CV, not the one you have. I am no longer on the board. I still read for Journalism History, but I'm going off the JQ board.
Okay.
I still get asked to review manuscripts for this and that, you know, different journals, but I'm not very actively involved.
So when you're talking about reading these manuscripts,
right,
are you talking reading manuscripts both for JQ and Journalism History?
Yep,
where you're seeing
this?
Referring
them into two.
Okay.
Should this submission be published? If not, why not? That sort of thing.
And you would see the same. You were having the same. Seeing the same type of scholarship early on in both.
Really, I thought it was pretty weak in the early going, and then gradually, as I say, it's gotten better. I think people, and part of this may be that the computerization of library access has changed people's ability to sort of capture what's going on in other fields, but it's gotten better.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure.
So last time I asked, during those early years, the first decade or so, if you ever thought about or took steps to possibly find a new job somewhere else. So during sort of your mid-career, did you look for opportunities to teach elsewhere?
Well, there weren't many. And part of the problem was, I don't think I was that good, to be honest with you. I don't think I was in demand. At least once I got confused with somebody else in the same last night, the name which I think is pretty funny, but that wasn't regarding a job application. I don't think I was that good. I think I was good enough. I mean, part of what was happening is that the field was changing, and I was sort of old school in the way I approach journalism, communication history. I have no apologies for that. I think I'm right in the way I do it, but it doesn't put me in, I'm not in demand. If you know what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
It's also been a tough, that doesn't mean I have been nominated for jobs occasionally, and I expressed an interest, if only to find out, you know, what have you got, you know, to offer. I was sorely tempted when a history department would come calling and ask me to consider applying, and I always did, if it was a reasonably good program. Not because I don't have a lot of affection for my program, but if I had a choice, I would, I would be in the history department.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the closest I came to leaving was, ironically enough, in the early 90s, when I applied to be dean at The Ohio State University's journalism school, and I was a finalist. And that would have been very interesting, Troy, had the call come, had I made it, because I would have been sorely tempted to do that, because I have family in Ohio, I'm fifth generation Buckeye. In retrospect, not getting it was a lucky break for me, because I think that program has since gone. gone in directions I wouldn't have been happy with. And by the same token, I've been well taken care of here.
Mm-hmm. So a couple more things.
Sure.
You talked early, I think actually the first thing you talked about was sort of being nice to staff. In relation to the actually getting the job here. I'm wondering if generally you could talk about some of the staff who worked or do work, if they still do, in the journalism school.
Oh, boy. Well, I think I would avoid that question for a couple of reasons, Troy. Maybe tell you off mic. We've had a fair amount of turnover over the years is one problem. We've got some really good people on staff right now. We've always had people I liked and, got along with here, but I think I might take the fifth on that one but for reasons I'd have to explain off mic.
Okay, that's fine. It's your interview.
I will give the rest of my answers in German.
Excellent. Well, I'll take them home, and between my wife and I, maybe we'll be able to translate them.
There you go.
So I think really the only thing I have at this point is you became chair in 2003, and we're going to talk about that in more depth in this third interview, but I wonder if we could sort of set the stage as to why that was a time you either felt compelled or for whatever reason you decided to become head of the college, or school, excuse me, not college.
A couple things. We had, during my first 12, 13 years on the faculty, and I'm not exaggerating, virtually nobody wanted to be director of the school. It was just a job nobody wanted. It was considered, and by that I mean the faculty I was closest to, Bill Blankenberg, Byron Reeves, Sharon Dunwoody, people like that, just thought that being director was an awful job and so forth. But at one point, I want to say around 1990-91, we as a faculty decided that we really needed to rotate. What had happened was we had a practice where if you agreed to be director, your term might be 5 or 10 years. And Jim Hoyt had been director for more than 10 years. And it was felt that it was in our interest for multiple reasons for more of us to have the job, to serve as director. So when we asked Jim to step down without prejudice, we said, Jim, we'd like a new director. Bob Drexel succeeded him, and then Sharon Dunwoody, both of whom were senior to me in age, though I was still the longest serving of the three of us. And in a sense, in 03, it was my turn. So we had moved from a model where nobody wanted it to where it became an obligation, unless you were a complete jerk, it was your turn.
Okay.
And again, that speaks to our being a fairly small department, but that was part of it.
Okay. So again, I think we want to, or I want to at least, focus our next interview on those, looks like 6, maybe 7 years, depending on how you slice it, as a director of the school. There is one more thing that you mentioned that I had forgot about till I just looked at my notes, and that's your involvement in Professor Sharpless's campaign for Congress.
Yeah.
Would you mind speaking to that?
Yeah, I don't know to what extent you're interested or you think this might be worth including. It was great fun. Scott Klug, who was a moderate Republican, was stepping down from the 2nd District, a seat he had won in 1990, and he was stepping down in 1998. And John Sharpless in the history department, who I knew slightly, informed me he wanted to run and would I help him. And I'd been mildly involved in Republican politics in the 80s, less so in the 90s. And I said, great, let's give it a go. And John started out, he ran twice, once for the nomination unsuccessfully in 98 and then successfully winning the nomination in 2000 and then almost beating Congressman Baldwin. He came as close to beating Tammy as anyone ever has. but the reason I wanted to share this was, I had studied politics since I was a little boy. And you have to actually be involved up front in a campaign, as I was with John, who where I was sort of in his College of Cardinals. I was advising him about this and that. You have to get that involved to realize what politics really is about and how exciting it is and how much fun it is and how frustrating, even heartbreaking it is. But I wouldn't trade that experience for anything. And I think I came away having learned a lot about the political process and I got to meet political operatives on both sides. But it's just a way to, and I've told grad students in particular since, if they get into a similar situation where they're teaching somewhere and a friend says, hey, I'm thinking of running for the Senate, I'm in. You just learn so much. Going down working a street fair or going to the pie tent in Randolph, Wisconsin, things like that, that you just don't pick up from a book or and again, I'm going to start sounding like some old codger, but it's just true. It's sort of hands-on encounters that were wonderful.
Jim, how is it in general being a Republican on a campus in a town that at least, most of the time that you've been here, if not all the time you've been here, leans to the left, if not falls to the left?
Well, it's been, in the 80s, my colleagues tolerated me. I think my own department was much more tolerant of me. I mean, because they thought I was sort of a goof, and they just gave me I was like the crazy uncle, But frankly, since then, it's been, the Sharpless campaign was frustrating because I think a lot of people wouldn't hear John out because he was running as a Republican. I'm not sure in retrospect, and I mean this, that some of those people weren't right, that the party was, the GOP was moving to the right. And I think even John, as his campaign in 2000, was more conservative than he had been 2 years earlier, less libertarian. He might argue with me about that. Now I'm pretty disillusioned with the GOP. And so if somebody wants to start attacking it or attacking me, that's fine, because I feel like the party is, it's not my grandfather's Republican Party.
Okay.
I don't have a problem with it. That said, I have fought and will continue to fight for free speech on campus and can't stand the intolerance that people show. I mean, part of that may be because I come from a more conservative perspective, but as far as the Republicans are concerned, it's pretty hard to be a Republican these days, but I'll stop.
Okay. So, Jim, this chronologically gets us then, to your time as director of the school. So is there anything on your mind, from the time period up to that time that you'd like to mention before we sign off for the day?
No, not that I can think of. It's been fun to talk to you about this stuff, and I hope these interviews have held some value.
Well, Jim, I want to thank you very much for your time today. I appreciate it. So this concludes the follow-up interview, the second interview with Jim Boffman.
All right. Today is January 15th, 2015. This is the addendum to the second interview with Jim Boffman. My name is Troy Reeves with the UW Mass Oral History Program. So, Jim, can you say your name and spell your last name?
Sure. James L. Boffman, B-A-U-G-H-M-A-N.
Thank you. So we just have a couple of questions we want to add to the end of this second interview. The first is, you said you wanted to have a bit of space to talk a bit more about, I called it sort of a gap in your publishing, in terms you had a book come out in 1992, and then your next new book came out in 2007.
Yeah, you were sort of quizzing me like a department chair might, but I thought about that, and I thought about my answer, and I think that there were maybe three reasons. One is that I'd produced a book in 87, and then another 5 years later in 92. And those were my second and third books. And I think at that point, I was a little burned out. But one of the reasons I was able to do those books was that I had contracts with deadlines. And I didn't want to get into the trap. I told this to myself, where I signed a contract with a publisher, and publishers were interested in the book I wanted to do about 50s television. But I didn't want another deadline looming over my head. I just didn't want to deal with that. I felt I'd spent the previous years worried to death that I wouldn't make it, would I get the thing finished? And part of the reason was this book, the book that I ultimately produced, was going to be my big book. It was probably going to be the most ambitious book I ever wrote in terms of length and all of that. And I just didn't want to be rushed. In retrospect, I probably needed a deadline, just as our students do. And the other thing is, the other source that sort of stalled me was structure. I was probably over-researching the book. I was looking at too many things. The scripts of Jimmy Durante TV shows that I didn't need to be reading. But sometime in the late 90s, I figured out a structure, which I pretty much adhered to when I began working on the book. I had to make one more decision, because despite my best efforts, and you will hear this from some people, I could never get enough writing done in the summer. So I took a full year's leave in 02 and 03 and essentially made myself finish the manuscript that year. I kept a weekly log of how many words I was writing, such that by the end of the sabbatical, I pretty much had the manuscript finished. I did spend another year or two polishing it up, but I needed to do that. I did it at some financial cost. As you know, when you take a full year leave, you take a 33% cut in your salary. I am not so savvy or faddish that I was able to acquire outside money, because there's so much competition for that, and I'm just not that smart a cowboy, so I couldn't get that extra money. But that sort of resolved the question. I think in retrospect, again, if I had do-overs in academic careers, I would have in fact sought a publisher and a deadline, and I would have worked harder on the outline. But I didn't. And I've been working ever since.
Mm-hmm. You know, maybe we should talk, since the book comes out during your time as department chair.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if we could talk about the book in this addendum, just because I think it's you're probably willing to talk about it. So the book came out in 2007. So initially, how pleased were you with the final result?
I was pretty pleased, and I'm not that vain about my work. It was a book that meant a great deal to me, because I'd been intrigued from my days in grad school by 50s television and the arguments about what shape TV should take. And I think I was able to capture that argument pretty well. And we got some nice reviews. I don't mean to speak of myself in the royal we, but the book got some nice reviews. I wish the book had sold better than it did. I got a glorious "I'm buying him a car" review in the New Yorker magazine that I really appreciated. But I went with a smaller university press, Johns Hopkins, and I think the marketing sort of slipped between the cracks. In retrospect, I should have probably gone with a bigger press and gotten more reviews. I may have waited too long. If the book had appeared 10 years earlier or 15 years, which was conceivable, I could have written it 10 years, certainly 5 years. There were more people who remembered 50s television. There were maybe more interest in it than there. By the time my book came out, it was the Peloponnesian Wars for some people. But that may be self-serving. I'm still rather proud of the book. Even though I make a fairly traditional argument about, and it's a management focused look, which most people in media studies today don't think is worthwhile, and I don't care.
Did you get criticism about that in any reviews?
Not that I've seen, but I think, you know, I think the when you go to conferences and you encounter people casually, they might say something to the effect that, poor Jim, he's focusing on this stuff and that's no longer what we do. And I was able to find a lot of new material on the managing of the three networks that we didn't know, and that was very interesting. And And it was really more of a business or entrepreneurial history than anything else. But that's an approach that a lot of people don't like. I've been told it's not even cultural history, and I hope all these people die young. just kidding.
So, were you able to? I know you're a department chair, and you said that Johns Hopkins publicism of it might not have been the best. Did you do any sort of tours for it?
Not really. I mean, I offered to, and I did a few. I did some radio interviews. I did make a couple of road trips to promote the book, but not many. And
would you have been? I guess you offered, so you would have been willing to promote it more if Hopkins wanted it promoted.
Yeah. And I will say Hopkins did a wonderful job with the production of the book itself. They had great copy editors and smart people. That was part of the seduction to me about working with Hopkins. Is I just had a lot of respect for the staff at the press, and still do, you know.
So. You said it was a substantial size book, but was there stuff in it stuff that didn't get in it that you wanted to?
Not really. It's interesting that. When the press committee, the university press committee, approved the publication, they did want the length of the book cut. And so I negotiated with my editor about that, and we came to a satisfactory conclusion. I did cut material from one of the chapters and didn't really regret that. I thought I liked what I'd written, but I didn't have any trouble taking it out.
Okay. So just that was the one substantial...
That I remember. That was I cut. There was a chapter in television advertising that I took a chunk of that out because it had the least to do with the rest of the book.
Okay.
And, you know, the production of stuff like this, you know, unless you're one of the history gods, there's always compromises involved in the production of something like this. And I finally learned this as I got older, that the authors don't have the authority over what they do that they think, you know, some people think they do.
Well, thank you for that. Two other things I want to talk about. One is from our first interview, and that was the racial tensions that were on campus in the 80s. You had alluded to the fact that you didn't agree with how the administration handled it. So I wonder if, just for the record, talk about how the administration handled it and why you felt that wasn't just.
And I will hearken back to what I said to you earlier, Troy, which is that I was heartsick over the episodes that were occurring at the frat houses. And I actually went to at least one meeting. I don't know if it was the faculty senate or it was just a conclave that Acting Chancellor Cohen convened. That spring, I believe, and I went to that as a faculty member concerned. So I don't want my comments to be taken as a sign of my not taking the problem seriously. I've thought a bit about this question, and I would add, just try to be as concise as I can here. I think in some ways the university overreacted to what was happening. By that I mean my very clear memory is that it was a subset of undergraduates who were misbehaving. And they needed to have their knuckles wrapped. They needed to be told that this kind of humor, racist humor, was inappropriate in no uncertain terms. But what happened very quickly, and this is my memory, and I could be, some of this could be contested, is that it became an indictment of the whole university. And I resented that. I resented it as someone who had been one of the few faculty members in my department who actually talked to my students about this and said this was wrong. I felt that the university, and maybe it was under pressure from African-American students and faculty to make the reaction more encompassing. And maybe I'm missing, as an old white guy, the depth of the problem. And I'm willing to listen to that if someone wants to challenge me. But I felt the university overreacted in a couple ways. Introduction of speech codes, I think, was inappropriate in part because how they could be enforced. I think there was a bureaucratic response. By that I mean, and you're much younger than I am, and I hope you hang around here forever, Troy, but every time there's a big crisis, they create a new office in the provost wing. And so they would hire somebody to oversee diversity efforts and so forth, adding to the already ballooning administrative costs of this university, which I think is one of the great underreported problems. And I speak here as somebody who takes his teaching and research seriously and resents every time a new administrative position is created, whatever the motives. But it's routinely the response of the university, we're going to hire this person at $150,000 a year to hold meetings all day to address the problem. So those were two things. There were other objections I had. I'm still have misgivings about the ethnic studies requirement. Is that really necessary? Because again, I think the problem was of a narrower making. I think it was, if that's phrased badly, forgive me, that it was really a subset of students, probably from Waukesha County and places, and you know, Mequon, Wisconsin, who were behaving badly. And the other thing that came up a lot at that meeting, and I think in subsequent conversations that I resented, is I'm someone who went to an integrated high school, who's from a blue-collar high school, who lived through the racial tensions in my adolescence. I don't need to be lectured about racism by people. And I resented the assumption that was sometimes carried that I did. Or that, you know, let's have a conversation, but don't lecture me about this stuff, is what I'm saying. And I say this as someone whose dad particularly was a strong champion, very quiet, but strong champion of racial tolerance. So a lot of the conversation that was going on in the late 80s and early 90s was off-putting to me. It carried with it the implication that we all needed to go to education camps or something like that. And again, I'm overstating, perhaps deliberately, but I don't want any of this to be taken as a measure that I didn't think we had a problem. I just think the dimensions were perhaps overstated. The other thing that rarely gets discussed is that we have a smaller African-American population in Wisconsin than states like Illinois and Ohio. It's also a poorer African-American population because, remember, the black migration in Milwaukee came later than it did to Chicago and Cleveland. So you have a smaller middle-class African-American population. So you have fewer African-Americans in the pool of applicants. And, you know, I was at Rufus King High School in the early 90s when I was on the Civil Rights Commission's State Advisory Committee. And I was talking to these wonderfully talented African-American seniors and juniors, and none of them were thinking of coming to Madison. I don't think that's because they regarded this as an outpost of the Ku Klux Klan. It's that there was a marketing problem. We weren't reaching out to those kids. Maybe they were feeling toward us the way a lot of us in Ohio in the 60s felt towards Ohio State. They didn't think of it as a serious academic institution, or the brand was diminished in some ways. Mm-hmm. What I don't know, I don't know if that kind of structural problem was really being addressed.
Thank you for that.
Yeah.
So now we're going to go from racial tensions to a question about socializing, I should say.
Right.
I told you this question was coming. It's a sort of a softball question.
Right, right.
But I think it is important to the culture of the campus, particularly faculty culture.
Right, right.
And so where, you know, besides here in your office or wherever your office was, what places on campus would you either meet other faculty or staff and socialize?
Well, it's changed over the time because, of course, I've been here, I think, since the Middle Ages. But a traditional hangout for many of us was the Nitty Gritty for lunch. Pisons, when it was across the mall here, was a frequent place we went to. I didn't use Memorial Union, go to Memorial Union as much as some faculty I know did. They've, of course, they fixed up the Ratskeller, and I can't stand it. I much preferred you know, when it was sort of decrepit, and they had that great soup that they would, stuff like that. But they've made everything cleaner now, and I'm just not as driven to that. But it was, so usually faculty would get together at a commercial venue like the Nitty Gritty or Paisans, and had some great lunches there over the years with different people in different departments.
Were there, or were you involved in sort of informal campus meetings, faculty meetings, where, you know, you might go somewhere, get a pitcher of beer, and talk about, you know, events of the day?
On Friday nights, and my friend David McDonald in history started this practice some, I want to say, 15 years ago. And you are more than welcome to join us. We meet at Jordan's Big Ten Pub on Regent Street at about 4:30, 5 o'clock, on Fridays. And that's great fun. I don't go every Friday, but it's a wonderful chance to interact with faculty and staff, including some Navy guys who've now work for the university, and it's great fun to talk to them because their, you know, their life experiences are so different from the rather, shall we say, dull lives we've led. And I mean, one guy was a Navy pilot, you know, and things like that. So that's good for me to meet people like that. But it's a wonderful group, and the food isn't bad. So you should join us sometime.
Yeah, that'd be great.
And you can, it's kid friendly, so you can bring the kids and
okay.
So
great. All right, so is there anything on your mind, again, sort of pre-department chair, that we want to get on this addendum before we move on?
No, not really. Right. Not really.
So this will wrap up. This wraps up the addendum to the second interview with Jim Bachman. Okay.